Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jason Irwin. Jason Irwin was born in Jamestown, New York in 1971 and grew up in Dunkirk, New York, where he attended both Catholic and public schools. He is a graduate of SUNY Fredonia and the MFA poetry program at Sarah Lawrence College. His new book is called Watering the Dead, published by Pavement Saw Press, and he now lives in Pittsburgh. Welcome, Jason. How
are
you doing?
Good. How are you? Thank you.
Congratulations on your book.
Thanks.
Yeah. And this just came out, right?
This spring, yes.
Okay. Spring of 08.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you're going to read some poems from the book?
Yep.
Okay.
This is called Nothing I Thought I Knew. Monday, I was the last seat in the back row in Mrs. Miller's fourth grade next to Joe Larravee, who picked his nose through spelling and the Gettysburg Address, dreaming I'd be a policeman, secret agent, or quarterback for the Buffalo Bills one day. Tuesday, I woke to the radio. The announcer talked about a man I'd never heard of, shot the night before. All day, the TV, radio, and newspaper spoke his name. They said he was a singer. My mother said it reminded her of when Bobby Kennedy was killed. It was the first time I'd seen her cry since my father moved out. Sunday, a memorial service interrupted Grandpa's football. My cousin and I sat in front of that giant oak-trimmed zenith, watched thousands crying in the rain outside Lincoln's memorial. They played one of his songs. The lyrics spun in my brain like a scratched record. I am the walrus, goo goo gajoob, spun like Monsignor Mengi's Good Friday sermon. And in that moment, I knew nothing I thought I knew before mattered, that somehow I was saved. This is called Main Street, where I grew up. From the front porch, we guessed colors of cars, drank lemonade out of paper cups, and listened to the Kapinski kids get beat by their mother. That dissonance reverberated through backyards where Virgin Marys kept vigil in bathtub grottos, and old man Tilly, senile and drunk, promised to pulverize us for throwing rocks at his truck. 20 years now since he surrendered to the Elks Memorial Home, and the Kapinskis moved to some godforsaken Des Moines or South Dayton after their mother's fourth husband realized he was a woman trapped in the wrong movie. I think of them, wonder what became of Priscilla, who showed me her privates behind the rabbit cage when we were 9, or Timmy and George, who were all teeth, sandy hair, and bruises no one ever questioned, not even Miss Butler, who taught third grade. I remember Sally, too, blue as the swimming pool where they found her, too young to cross the street alone or read Hamlet. Sometimes I drive by the old house on Main Street. I can still see them, faces and fists against glass. This is called Dog Days. That was the summer my father took an axe to our picnic table, and my mother began a 10-year affair with Jesus. The Ayatollah Khomeini replaced Darth Vader as the number one bad guy in the universe. I was 9 years old and still a dog, barking through the house in my fuzzy feet with no idea where Tehran was or what divorce meant. It's called April 1989. Grandpa whistled through Grandma's cancer seizures and called on Christ's whiskers to help the Yankees come from behind and beat those Indians. Easter came and went without eggs or candy that year. I learned to drive and counted the days till high school was over. Some days I hung out with friends or drove my mother's car till the gas was gone. Other days I sat on the living room floor, watched my mom and Aunt Stephanie wipe drool from Grandma's chin after the shaking and rattling of bed rails stopped. They patted her forehead with a damp cloth, fluffed her pillow, and stroked her hands, hands too weak to stir spaghetti sauce or grasp rosary beads. Grandpa just stared straight ahead, cursing the TV. Between innings, he locked himself in the bathroom. I pretended I didn't hear him sob over the running water.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jason Irwin. He's reading from his new book, Watering the Dead. Jason, I wanted to ask you about the worlds that you create in your poems. You have a great sense of place going on and all kinds of characters. There's so much naming happening in your poems. Does that come out due to where you get your material, or is that come out in the writing process, all this naming and detailing?
Some of the names are made up and some are real from my hometown, so it's all about those people.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about your sense of place a little bit as a writer, how important it is to you, or how much you think it defines your poetry?
I think my town, Dunkirk, defines the whole book, pretty much. And that's, for 3 years, it's all I was writing about, even though I wasn't living there anymore.
Mm-hmm. That's some of the work that you did while you were at Sarah Lawrence.
Yeah. Started before I went there, but then much more after when I got there.
Mm-hmm. It seems like that's a really great program there.
That was very good.
Yeah.
Good group of people.
Okay. I could tell you're a man of few words here. Okay. but not in your poem. So why don't you read a few more and then we'll talk, okay?
This is called Barcelona. They were among the first settlers here, not long after the war for independence was won. My father's people, square-jawed, Scotch-Irish Presbyterian stock, fishermen, farmers, and factory workers all, pale as salt and stern as the god that sent down fire on Sodom and Gomorrah. These are the people I never knew, but know through photos yellowed by so many seasons my grandmother left when God in his mercy blessed her one October day with a stroke, and she was free of widowhood, colon cancer, and cataracts. It was here in Barcelona, New York, in the southern shores of Lake Erie, that once swelled with whitefish, blue pike, and herring, where the first gas-powered lighthouse was built in 1829, where my father was born. Here, where Dr. Thomas Branwell Welch invented a way to preserve unfermented grapes, where Grace Bedell, age 11, suggested to Abe Lincoln that he would look a lot better if he grew whiskers. Here, where the winters last until midsummer, and here, where my life will surely end just as it began, a speck of dust lost in a universe that rarely acknowledges the dreams of an ordinary man. This is called Pocket Knife. Sitting on the back porch steps by the Raspberries Rebellion, I finger your tobacco-stained Kingston pocket knife as if it were a magic lamp that might connect me to you once more. The knife you chipped Captain Black from your pipe with, hands, fingers swollen from gout and arthritis, hands that shoveled coal into steel plant furnaces for 40 years, taught me to peel an apple, hold a bat. The same knife you gave me for my 10th birthday I swore I lost playing kickball. The same knife Uncle Joe found in a kitchen drawer looking for money and old baseball cards. Above where Grandma kept aprons, buried in a mass grave of empty scotch tape dispensers matchbooks, and expired coupons. Found the day after your funeral, like that photograph in an old cigar box on the cellar stairs. You in Wallace, Idaho, summer 1933, standing so proud on that rocky bluff, hands deep in denim pockets, dimpled smile, thick dago hair, looking like I look now, age 30, wishing I had the courage to hug you more. This is called Cadillacs. Devout as priests, far enough from their youth to bemoan the changing times, these working men, sons of Sisyphus, toil in the purgatory of Monday through Friday, men hard as gravel, shredded and torn, fingers gone, stripped like old bolts. Men like my father, who talked about someday as if it were an actual date, like Christmas or the 4th of July. Someday, he'd say, when I save enough money, I'm going to tell them where they can shove it. 35 years for a watch and hip surgery. I see these men at night in diners and bars, hunched and quiet, faces cracked, bloodless, unused to sun or smiles, reading the papers, playing numbers, men broken by the promises of a good, hard day, promises made by men without mortgages or used cars, men with soft hands. After last call, they wander, the car dealers with heavy feet and lovesick eyes, groping the Cadillacs they will never buy.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jason Irwin. He's reading from his book, Watering the Dead, which was just published by Pavement Saw Press. Okay, I want to ask you about the narrative nature of your work. Your work seems really narrative to me.
Yeah.
And yet it's sort of punctuated by all these iconic markings of time, like, you know, it seems like you bring in a lot of historical references or time references, like, you know, earlier referring to the Ayatollah, RFK, you know, and just in this last set of poems, you talked about you use maybe less known people to mark time, but, you know, you talked about Grace Bettle suggesting to Abraham Lincoln that he grow a beard, and even the mother in the poem, you have this moment when you say, you in Wallace, Idaho, 1933. It's an interesting voice that comes in that is sort of announcing almost, but it's also woven into the narrative. Now, can you talk about that move to mark time in your poems rather than staying right in the narrative?
I guess it was, I started trying to write fiction, and I was not good at it, the plot and all that. And
yeah.
I wanted to try to write a poem book of, you know, like a coming-of-age story in poems.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's trying to fit everything about my town, my life, and everything related to its history.
Mm-hmm. So what's the relationship to fiction?
That has, a lot of people have told me that it sounds very prosy, the writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's in that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it definitely sounds like poetry to me, but, and it doesn't sound at all like a prose poem.
Yeah.
But what are they referring to, do you think, when they say that?
I think because it's wordy, maybe.
It's not wordy.
I don't know.
Don't listen to that. It's not wordy at all. But, I mean, it's a well-constructed narrative, but I guess what I'm trying to get to is, what is important to you as a writer about having those markers in your poetry rather than the floating story without the connection to the larger history?
It makes me feel grounded, that there's
something just besides telling the story to make it connected maybe to other people.
Mm-hmm. And why is that a good thing?
So it's not just me talking about myself and my life.
Mm-hmm.
So it reaches out.
So you're saying all of this is autobiographical? Or I mean, I'm sure there's details here that are,
yeah,
that are not.
Most of it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Some things made up.
Uh-huh. I'm sure. Okay. This Watering the Dead by Pavement Saw Press. Where is Pavement Saw out of?
Montpelier, Ohio.
Okay.
Used to be in Columbus.
And was this, you won?
The Transcontinental Award.
Poetry Award, okay.
The same one as Justin.
You're referring to Justin Vicari?
Yes.
Okay.
I couldn't think of his last.
For our listeners, yes. Watering the Dead was the winner of the 2006-2007 Transcontinental Poetry Award. And for our listeners out there, can you tell them what that is? Is that a first book award?
It's a first book award. The deadline is every August.
Okay. Okay. And they did a nice job on your book, so,
you know,
for those of you out there listening, it might be something you want to send into. So, okay, what about some more poems?
Okay. This is a little longer one. It's called Tokyo and the Rio Grande. It's about driving, trying to get away from a small town, I guess. I was not yet 26 that January. I drove cross-country with two women, one of whom I was foolishly in love with, for she was in love with a herbologist from L.A., and the other one who chewed bubble gum and talked about nothing but Brad Pitt and Scientology. We picked up at a diner outside Mobile. And though I'd been to Ireland and Bermuda, it was my first time west of Ohio. On Interstate 40, somewhere between Blue Water and Thoreau, my head buried in the pages of a road atlas, my fingers following our course, I marked off cities and towns we passed and remembered how, as a child, I'd sit for hours gazing at maps, transfixed by longitudes and latitudes, infatuated by topographies, maps of rainfall distribution, ocean currents, vegetation and mineral maps, maps that show the relative motion of tectonic plates, changes in sovereignty, military advances and retreats. How I was smote with historical maps, grew dizzy over political and population maps, maps that measured the depths of oceans, lengths of rivers, world maps, regional maps, and city maps. All these maps filled me with a longing for someplace other, like the stories my Uncle Joe told of his days in Buffalo, Boston, and New York, wandering streets, working in a garment factory, selling his blood for wine, and being rejected by the Nation of Islam because he was white. Each time I opened an atlas, those wondrous melodies and rhythms played in my ears, places 10 years after the first cross-country trip. I still have yet to see Zanzibar, Marrakesh, Calabria, and Wolverhampton, Argentina, Pakistan, Tokyo, and the Rio Grande.
That idea of mapping, I wonder if that has any relationship to this, what we were talking about. I really like that poem, but yes. That idea of placement, you know, where is the speaker in that poem placing himself? You know, he's in the small town, but wanting to go out. And this idea of the speaker in all of your poems here, but noticing this in relation to that, this in relation to that. It's sort of a nice sort of web of things that's being set up.
Thank you. I was obsessed with maps as a kid.
Me too. I love maps.
Really?
Oh yeah. I still have them on my walls because I still want to go
mm-hmm.
everywhere. You too?
Yeah.
Let's go. Let's get out of here. Okay. Go ahead. More poems, please.
Okay. Okay, I'll read Watering the Dead. At the cemetery drive-thru, Jesus waves hello, blesses me as I turn the radio off and make the sign of the cross. The headstones call out, eager for a word or glance from the living. Their names take flight in my mind. Catalano, Vicanti, Bartolomeo, Joe. I walk to the sprinkler and remember the old man who used to live across the street, always on his front steps, hands clasped, black jacket, smiling. He'd throw us the ball back when one of us hit a home run. We called him Joe, though my grandfather said his name was Sal. At my grandparents' grave, I offer a prayer, bend to pull weeds, water the geraniums my mother planted on Memorial Day. Content among the dead, I sprawl on the fresh-cut grass, watch an angel with a missing left hand, arms outstretched, smiling like Joe smiled. I close my eyes and see him and my grandfather, sitting at a baseball game or spaghetti dinner. Some nights, they're the crickets outside my window, singing me to sleep. It's called Some Days It's a Love Story, and based on a grocery store I worked at for a number of years. At P&G Grocery, the dairy manager has a bachelor's in economics and a pulled groin from lifting crates of milk. He's been writing the first chapter to a novel for 6 years. Some days it's a love story, some days a comedy, about people in a small town, like the guy in aisle 8 who fits all he learned from his father into his right hand and smacks his son for asking too many questions. Or the cashier at Express, who flirts with the younger bank teller who comes in every day for lunch. Handing him change, she smiles, avoids his eyes, and remembers it's been over 2 years since she's been kissed. Outside, a factory worker, fresh off the midnight trick, climbs into a beat-up Chevy, opens a can of Milwaukee's Best he bought for breakfast, takes a sip, sets it between his legs, keys the ignition, and thinks about the day his wife left, complaining he was the one who changed. This is called Get Out. The first light of morning fills the spaces between tree branches and houses along the avenue. You scrape frost from the windshield of a rented truck, blow into your numb hands and watch your breath escape the way you plan to escape, the way your father did all those summer times ago. Just get the hell out, with nothing to guide you, save an overwhelming desire you find hard to describe, that uncertainty that grows down deep in men, makes them question the simple comforts and securities they've been taught to be thankful for. One thing you do know, you won't grow old and die in this town, with that desire still burning your lips when they lower you in the ground. You won't work your life away without taking that talked-about chance. Inside the truck, you crank the radio, inhale your last cigarette, and head south. On the highway, it all seems perfect, the future spread out before you, like the most beautiful woman in the world. This is called All Saints Day, 1987. It was a Sunday, the day after Halloween. I was walking to church, hung over from drinking Jenny Cream Ale out of mayonnaise jars in Scott Jagoda's garage. In my pockets, a bunch of Three Musketeer bars Joe Ranka stole from a kid dressed as Superman on Deer Street. My feet slid on the icy sidewalk as a man came out his front door, walked up to me and asked if I knew his daughter, Pam Cushing. Yes, I said, all the while looking at his eyes that didn't appear
to be looking at anything. "She was killed last night," he said, as calm as if he were telling me what he ate for breakfast. "You know Ryan Hayes? He was driving. Tried to beat a train on Roberts Road. Everyone died. 6 of them," he concluded in the same monotone and walked back into his house. I stood watching the screen door slam against its frame, trying to understand what had happened, then continued on my way, thinking there probably wouldn't be school on Monday.
We have time for just one more, I think.
Okay. It's called Going Home. Across from the Babe Ruth field, where Eddie Zappi pitched 3 perfect games and could have made it if not for Booze and Stacy Watson, I kicked the dust in the parking lot at the old steel mill, where both my grandfathers did time. Watched the sun through broken windows, the bricks and rust. 10 years since anyone worked here. Downtown, it's just as quiet. A few old men on benches and kids on bikes racing red lights. All the stores went in 75. Now there's a Walmart out by the thruway. On Center Street, it's the same fat girl behind the counter at the convenience store. The same empty boxcars on the 3rd Street overpass. And at Sarah's Tavern, the same faces drink the once local draft day after day, like the old women who chant novenas and lust after the priests at St. Mary's. I can hardly imagine what Dunkirk was like when my mother was young, let alone in 1851, when the first train arrived with President Fillmore and Daniel Webster on board. There are people here who talk of leaving, but only go as far as Bruce's corner store or the Greek diner at the dock. Maybe it's the view of the hills to the south or the 3 smokestacks of the electric plant at sunset that keep us here. Or maybe it's the sound of my own voice reciting the streets named for birds and fish as if they were the names of saints.
It's the poetry of Jason Irwin reading from his new book, Watering the Dead. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nice poems. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wade. Our sound engineers are Amy Sutton, Michelle Stoner, and Ben Cole. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, independent public radio, 91.3 WYEP.